All right.
This is a oral history interview with Dr. Edward Bowles. The date is August 20th, 1987. The interviewers are Martin Collins speaking and Michael Dennis, and we're at Dr. Bowles' home in Wellesley Hills, Massachusetts. This is tape one, side one. Did you want to make some introductory comments here?
Yes, I'd like to. Do we have the Shockley paper on the Russia? Oh, bless you. The B-29 report, which is vital for its relationship to Rand, this folder marked Special Bombardment Project is, in my mind, a significant outline of the beginning of what later became known as Project Rand. Here, there are copies of the communication to Arnold. On the idea of introducing the idea into the Air Force of having the industrial people, particularly those concerned with the development of a specific equipment, behind the scenes in the Air Force with respect to all the super secret planning. In this instance, it dealt with the B-29s. And so this has the detailed information on how the project started. And it's this little piece of paper here, Arnold's initials on it.
Let me just, for the record, indicate the date of this memorandum. It's 1 September 1944 from Dr. Bull's personal papers, the file on the B-29 Special Bombardment Project.
And in the Arnold organization, his word was law within the family, within the Air Force, Army Air Corps family. And the letter itself, September 1, 1944, at Arnold's initials, General Cooter and General Craig give this project full support. And this little piece of paper that I have just referred to before, you've taken down the date, 1 September 44, and I won't say to add humor, but to add a little information on Arnold's character, I wanted to be sure to help the project along, and I'm referring to the Raymond Colbum Wells gathering. Arnold was in officer's mess number one, having his noonday meal, which was, he didn't do very often. And I was somehow party to the privilege of eating in that room. That included the general staff of the Army and the sub-staff of the Air Force, like Bob Lovett. And I walked in with this little piece of paper and put it before Arnold, because I thought that in that lunchroom he would be able to put his mind on what I was talking about, where I was going into his office. Most of the time he was working on one problem and then on another, and lots of times his mind was a bit far from the point. I put this before him, and there again he reapproved. So it's a fairly respectable documentation of the beginning of the Raymond Colbum Wells study.
When you indicate that you feel this is the kind of inception of the RAND idea, are you referring more to the group of people who are brought together that eventually form the core of RAND, or are you talking more about the idea of the project itself?
The concept of that kind of study, as opposed to a study that's made independent of the sources of material and the design of material. Up to that point, the technique was the boys in the Air Corps, in collaboration with companies like Douglas and Boeing and North American and two or three more companies, but they would, the Air Force would produce an idea of what kind of an airplane they wanted. And the industry would in turn make comments on it. And there'd be a lot of shopping. Ultimately, the Air Force would have to select a company to carry out the design and manufacture of that airplane. And the design was very definitely what the boys at Wright Field determined was the kind of airplane that should be ordered. And it had all the biases of the industrial companies, each one hoping that it would get the order. And it was my judgment that the industrial companies wanted to get the business were never given any more than the Air Force decided it would tell them on the requirements that had been engendered by the intelligence activities in the Air Force. That is, the manufacturer didn't have the benefit in initiating the design, the benefit of knowing where the enemy stood with respect to development. In this instance, it was more specifically the Japanese. That was a question, matter of security. And the industrial concern having to build an airplane was, he was competing with his compatriots, fellow industrial organizations, without the full knowledge on which he could base his own recommendations. In other words, the airplane was a vehicle to carry bombs. That was seemed to be the primary emphasis, along with the defense. In other words, the equipment to defend itself if attacked by fighters. And what I was trying to sell Arnold on the importance of going at this thing not backward as they were, but bringing the designers into the planning area of the Air Force. Now that was a sacrosanct area. You couldn't get into it. So it seemed to me that was a waste of time to use the airplane as a vehicle where the Air Force would decide what they wanted to put in it, including radar. So the design was to make a carrier without knowledge of the specific requirements that should be dictated by the enemy, knowledge of the enemy's ability. And Arnold bought the idea, to use the expression. And that, I then went to Douglas. I saw more of Don Douglas than most anybody else. I went to him. I went to Boeing. As I remembered, it was Ed Allen of Boeing and Kindleberger. And asked Douglas Boeing, North American, to contribute a man to collaborate on this planning operation. In other words, indicating that they would be sworn in security-wise that they would be briefed by the Air Force on the then existing intelligence on the Jap airplanes. It would be fighters. And that went into effect because Douglas contributed Arthur Raymond. Raymond needed an assistant, and Kolbaum, I knew from my past work with Douglas on World War II. Frank was the salesman, a peddler, and Raymond was the chief engineer of Douglas, preoccupied with many problems, and so what he did was put Arthur Raymond on the job of the office aspect of the work.
You mean you put Frank Kolbaum on it?
I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Frank Kolbaum. So Kolbaum in that sense did not have a primary position. Boeing contributed Ed Wells. So the group that was sworn in comprised Arthur Raymond, Frank Kolbaum as his assistant, really, and Ed Wells. And they were well received in the Air Force. Insofar as I know, they were given a briefing on all the information we had in this instance on the Jap fighter. In other words, the opposition of the B-29 effort. Now,
I mean, before you move on, did North American decide not to contribute somebody to the study? Is that correct?
That's right. And I'm at fault for not getting into it more deeply with respect to the organizations. Boeing, for instance, I was disappointed. Ed Wells was not a choice. I can't remember exactly what his job was with Boeing, but I had never heard of him before, and although I'd had many contacts with the top dogs out at Boeing. I think it's fair to say that it was Don Douglas's relationship to Hap Arnold that, I believe it was Don Douglas's son that married one of the Arnold daughters. And there was never any difficulty of talking to Don Douglas rather intimately about these things. Back to Boeing, I was disappointed that they didn't ante up one of their top dogs. Wellwood Beale was the person I had would have hoped to get as their top engineering brain out there. Now, the weakness was that I didn't take the time or imagination to go and seek help from other aircraft companies, but I had to use my judgment, and that's always a matter of if everything works all right, it's wonderful. If you think it doesn't work all right, your judgment was bad. But I felt that trying first to get a plebiscite from the industry would make it very difficult in the Air Force because this was a new and novel idea. Now, this B-29 report has the report by signed by Raymond and Goldbaum and Ed Wells and this file has not been violated. That's just as it was in my office with the successive steps. Now, the report came out in a relatively short time. And you've probably seen it in here. What it did was to recommend stripping the B-29s of the deflection radar controlled shooting. In other words, great big GE turrets on each side of the body. And there is, I could determine they never hit anything. But they were tonnage added to the weight of the airplane. And there again, it comes back to my own idea, not my idea, but common sense, that somehow they wanted to defend, the boys in the back room wanted to see that there was adequate defense. The GE, no doubt, was interested in selling that radar equipment. They were the successful competitors. So it ended up with two radar fire control turrets on each side of the airplane. And as I recall it, there was an inadequate automatic weapon defense in the tail. Now, this committee, if you want to call them that, the Raymond Committee, found that the waste guns didn't do any good, that the tail guns were inadequate. The Raymond group indicated a 20-millimeter cannon with respectable radar fire control. The intelligence had demonstrated that the taking off the waste guns, taking the armor off the pilot's seat, he didn't like that much. But it would increase the ceiling speed by 40 miles an hour. So in a sense, speed was the defense. Secondly, the intelligence on the fighters of the Jap defense problem indicated that the Jap fighters would have to make a tail approach to get anywhere with that extra speed, or the increase in speed. Now, taking that armor off the waist guns and the pilot seat added directly to the capacity of the airplane to carry bombs, which is, let us say, the purpose of the whole business. And if you look at the report, here I don't take the time to get my fingers on it, it's in here, but it's an impressive array of what the study showed should be done.
Like some help with that, Dr. Bowles.
somewhere in there, later when I was in Hawaii, there was a general officer that I respected highly, and an air officer, and I went over it with him. And he, in a letter to me that's somewhere in the files there, he called this the Sally Rand version, because it was stripped down.
Is that where the name Rand comes from?
That's, as they say on television, that's a good question. Now, I like to believe that that was Frank Kolbaum's idea of a name. Essentially a salesman. And give it a nice name. I never felt that Arthur Raymond cared a damn.
I think this is the survey.
There are two columns here.
And it starts here, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And for the record, we're referring to the 4 October 1944 report of Arthur Raymond, Frank Kolbaum, and Edward Wells.
Yeah. Yeah, the prison airplane versus the revised airplane. Now, buzzing around the office was our friend Kolbaum. And I'll take the liberty of going back a little distance.
Can I ask a question first?
Yeah.
We've been talking about the B-29 study, and it's interesting after all that it's not, these are the people who will become part of Project RAND,
no.
But it is not yet Project RAND. It is just a B-29 survey, which they did.
All right.
I'm curious, how then did this one episode, in which you brought the airframe industry designers into strategic planning, how was this, did you translate this one happening into an ongoing project?
It brings me back to Hap Arnold himself. I think it was Archimedes or some one of the old timers.
He is an old timer.
Archimedes is beyond an old timer, Dr. Paul.
Who said, give me a place to put my feet. This is on the subject of a lever. I'll raise the world. Now, the point I ought to make, and thank you for picking it up, without being able to get my back against Arnold, simple English, I wouldn't have been able to do anything. Arnold put away $10 million, secreted it. I flatter myself of thinking I'm the only one who knew about it. And that was to go through and establish a working operation based on the principles of the study of doing a wholesome job of planning, not limiting it to the interior men, with due respect. And right field was, Arnold was not interested in anything technical. Right field had become like MIT. We'll get there maybe later. It was parochial. There were no signs of genius. When I say that, that's asking too much in life. But usually in an organization, there are some people that earn a distinction for a contribution. I wasn't aware, not that that means I was completely right, if I dare qualify the word right. But I saw no real illuminating talent. I think that's one of the problems in the military, that these people get ordered from place to place to place, and if one goes to the Vietnam situation, that's jumping a long distance, but they put in command a top dog from the Engineers Corps. I'll think of his name presently, but my mind gets to be a blank too frequently. I knew the man. Now, in theory, behind the scenes, trying to reflect the Washington atmosphere, the way to promote these men who have done distinguished work was to give them a command, because a command was a great honor and they can give him more rank. And they put in charge, in command, a man who was essentially an engineer. I'm raising no claims against the engineer. Theoretically, I guess I was supposed to be one by graduation from MIT. But the point is, he had no combat experience of any sort. And he's the one who asked Arnold for 5,000 more troops or something of that sort, according to the gossip, and he failed completely to be able to take into account that it was hundreds of thousands of people over there, including the civilians, taking arms against us. Now, my only point here is that going back to right field, there was parochialism throughout. Each man knew his job, and had made it impossible to, not impossible, but made it difficult to inject talent. And with respect to the, what is dubbed the B-29 project, what I guess I was doing is grafting. That is, bringing in talent from the outside world for the most critical judgments, that is the planning problem. And I know that General McNarney had told, I was one of my good friends, he's the deputy to marshal, he said there is no planning in the Pentagon. Now, that's seemingly getting away, but planning was an entirely different term as it was interpreted by the boys down in the office, and what I thought was needed. Now, that doesn't answer your question.
But can I ask a related question to what you've just said? it cuts both ways, though. You brought into the military the industrial component of the Army Air Force. And the image you've just given of Army Air Force is one that is a picture of an organization that was literally driven by the, at least before the Second World War, by the what the industry had to sell. That is,
yes,
you
yes.
know, GE, Sperry, right. Northrop Douglas, right. what they had to sell was what the military bought. And this was a complaint that, as you know, you made during the war, as did other people, Dr. Compton, Merle Tu, Dr. Bush, made a similar complaint. But your solution, which was to bring the airframe manufacturers into the Pentagon, it actually helped them a great deal too, didn't it?
I hope so.
In other words, did you see...
It was mutual.
Right. Did you see this, though, as a way to sustain that, the airframe industry in the post-war period when the number of bombers that the government was going to need was going to dramatically decline? That is, when the industry would become depressed.
You're right. No, it's a good thought. I guess I was impetuous, and I didn't think of all the problems. But my impulse, if you use that rather loose term, I had been interested in the economics of warfare, for one thing. I'm telling you this just to indicate the background, my background, and what prompted my thinking. The economics of warfare. I have here a report by Shockley on Russian, Russian capabilities.
Let's just read this in for the record here. For the tape, this is a report by W.B. Shockley, 30 January 1946, entitled Relative Technological Achievements in Weapon Characteristics in USSR and USA.
Shockley is a Nobel Prize man. He's one of the three people who was cited for the development of the transistor. A very distinguished person. In other words, I'll say that he might be called a physicist, but he was an unusual physicist. He was productive. Now, I was concerned, looking into the various alleys of thought in the Pentagon, there was a hell of a lot of noise about the Russians, but I saw nowhere an analysis of their capabilities, militarily speaking. And the Russians wanted to help in the technological fields during the war, and we picked one of our dumb individuals, I thought, to go over there and represent electronics for them. Now, the selection was based, as near as I could make out, by our bias against the Russians. We did not send the top dog over there, but somebody who wouldn't be missed. I know the character, so I'll keep quiet beyond that. No. On the economic side, Shockley made a study for me on the relative economic value. Putting a B-29 over Tokyo, how much did we take away money-wise, let's say, the damage in terms measured by the amount of money it would take to offset the damage, vis-a-vis the cost to the United States to produce that B-29, training, men, all. What did it cost us to put the plane over there? I was exposed to the thought that our job is to beat the hell out of them, figuratively. And I didn't see anyone worrying about the thought, the cost to do this. I believe, I can't say there was anything unique about the thought, but the atmosphere was one where just create more and more, produce more and more men, produce more and more equipment, more and more bombs, ammunition, etc. No thought that we might go bankrupt and lose the war that way. A remote. I think beat Vietnam as an illustration. I don't believe there was any real analysis. If they were doing the same damn thing in the Persian Gulf, we go over there and find there are a hell of a lot of mines. But I think our eminent president didn't worry about such things, and the Navy shown caught with its pants down on a very simple defense. These mines. Now, one of the things that we had already done, Shockley was a prime mover in it. We're sending a bomber out, notably the B-29s. A typical, I would say, high school intellect. There was a source of crews, ground crews to maintain the airplane. There was a gunfire training ground. Teach boys how to run the machine guns in the defense of the airplane. There was the training the bombardier, a school from which you could draw the bombardiers, and another school from which you drew the pilots. And they had never been introduced to one another. Now, one of Shockley's contributions had been to get into the training of the bombardiers, because we were having missions where the boys were baffled and not highly trained. So a failing bombardier meant you lost the benefit of the mission. There was no, use the word coordination. Now it's easy to criticize, but that was prevalent. And you go back to the 315th and 316th wings of the B-29s, they were a thoroughly trained, coordinated group. And somewhere in my records here, and maybe in the B-29 records, there's a cablegram showing that never had visual bombing done the damage of the radar bombing of the 315th wing. I think it was the 215th wing, and the 315th wing was in training when the war ended. Now, I had a background of all these things, and whether or not I was a visionary was, I think, insignificant. But I had visualized RAND as an honest to God study project where it was to go ahead and do a lot of these things, using the B-29 project merely as a starting point.
Let me just interrupt here so we can switch the tape over at the end of